The following program is a presentation of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction.
I know that you can start a successful, nationally known business with just a few dollars in your pocket, because I did. Find out how right now. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? I'm David Bluestein.
And I'm Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction in San Antonio.
We're here each Saturday morning at 7 o'clock to provide an insider's view on the world of jewelry, coins, antiques, collectibles, and much more. As owners and operators of the Jewelry Exchange and Auction, we're on the front line with a finger on the pulse of these markets every day. And as of right now, you have a friend in the business. Yes, you can start a successful nationally known business with just a few dollars in your pocket. I did. And today on our Insider Report, you'll get the inside story on exactly how I did that. Also, we'll be talking to Pamela O'Neill from Pamela's Parlors, a successful San Antonio small antique and jewelry dealer whose business is growing right before our eyes. And we'll be taking your calls and emails on the subject of dealing small, starting and running a successful business in a small space, on a small budget, supplementing your regular income, or even generating the income you need to quit your job. A couple of weeks ago, I outlined my own story of the steps that led to the Jewelry Exchange and Auction, San Antonio's premier auction gallery up in Stone Oak. And on that same program, we talked to our friend Chucky Buchel, a 13-year-old entrepreneur with general knowledge about coins and currency that enables him to make $100 or more in just a couple of hours. I've seen him do that. If I could do it at the age of 29 with essentially no knowledge at all, I mean, start a business buying and selling stuff. And look, if Chucky can do it at the age of 13, and frankly, I've been watching him do it since he was 10, well, what's your excuse? Adam, let's go right into this week's trivia quiz. It's the In the Money trivia quiz, the quiz where you win the answer. We always start with a review of last week's quiz. And here was last week's question. We'll give you the answer in a second. Until the South African Krugerrand, Canadian Maple Leaf, American Eagle Gold, and other even increment 1 ounce gold coins came along, the Mexican gold peso series was one of the most popular ways to own bullion-related coins. The gold pesos are still popular in South Texas for obvious reasons. The largest coin in the Mexican gold peso series is the Centenario, the 50 peso coin that contains 1.2 ounces of pure gold. And although they last struck the Centenario in 1947, they were last dated in 1947. The 1947 dies were used by the Mexican Mint to strike coins for several years past that date. And currently, the Centenario worth about $2,000. Now, the smallest coin in the series is not the 1 peso coin. Our In the Money trivia quiz question last week: what is it? What's the smallest coin in the Mexican gold peso series? The answer: the Mexican 2 peso gold coin, dos pesos. In that series, there's the 50 peso Centenario, the 20 peso, 10 peso, 5 peso, 2.5 peso, a dos y medio, and the dos pesos. The interesting thing about this series is that the ratio stays the same. If you have 2 20s and a 10, it's the same as the 50. If you have 2 2.5s, it's the same as the 5. Makes it an easy series to deal with, but when the master coin, the 50 peso, is 1.2 ounces, it's a little difficult, and that's why these 1 ounce, half ounce, quarter ounce, and 10th ounce coins are so popular right now. Anyway, we had a winner. The winner, Sanford Pliskin. He's the first one to contact us with the correct answer, dos pesos. And the prize is, the Mexican 2 peso gold coin. Remember, this is the quiz where you win the answer.
How much is that worth, approximately?
Right now, we sold 12 of them last Saturday night at auction in one lot, and I think they went for about $85 a piece, something like that. Mr. Pliskin, come to the Jewelry Exchange and Auction, 19903 Stone Oak Parkway. Come within the next 30 days to claim your Mexican 2-peso gold coin. With the way the price of gold is changing, it might be worth several thousand dollars by the time you get there, or not. Our gallery is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m., Saturday evenings for our live auction. Come anytime we're open. For more information, just click the Contact Us tab on our website at jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And now, for this week's quiz, Adam?
All right, this week I have another gemstone question for you. This gemstone can take billions of years to form under the intense heat and pressure 100 miles below the Earth's crust, and then pushed to the surface by volcanoes. It's primarily made out of carbon, and it is the hardest material on Earth. What is it? To be a winner this week, all you have to do is be the first person to email the correct answer to quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. You can also submit your answer directly from our homepage at www.inthemoneyradio.com. Then listen to next week's show and see if we read your name on the air. If we do, come claim your prize at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction at 19903 Stone Oak Parkway. Within the next 30 days, enter as often as you like, but please, only one winner per household per month. And remember, that email address is quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. That's quiz@inthemoneyradio.com. And good luck.
Well, I think I have a pretty good idea what the answer is. I'm just sitting here wondering what it's going to cost me. I hope you took that into consideration. I'm getting old, and I need a pension someday, remember. Folks, we usually take a short commercial break here, but instead we want to take this opportunity to tell you about the coming week up at the Jewelry Exchange. Interesting week. Tonight, of course, at 7 o'clock is our regular auction. We do that every week. We start with a number of collectibles and then go on to the coin case, coins and currency. And this week we have a pair of tusks, of genuine ivory tusks, that ordinarily we're not allowed to...
That's right. These are African ivory.
Yeah, we're ordinarily not allowed to sell that, but this this consignor had all the right paperwork, so we don't get in trouble with the federal government.
That's right.
And we've got a legendary three-legged buffalo, the 1937D buffalo nickel, all sorts of goodies. And then we're going to move over to the jewelry case. I meant to bring a account with me, but I forgot. But I'm picturing the case in my mind. If we don't have at least 100 pieces of silver James Avery jewelry this week, estate Avery, I'll eat it, because I know there's at least 100 pieces in there. And most of you know that we do an auction every Saturday night in Stone Oak, and we love to have Avery because people really like Avery. Here we are in South Texas, and that's the home of James Avery.
And tonight we also have Rolexes and Movado. And
how many Rolexes tonight?
I've got four Rolexes, Mont Blanc.
And there's a Tag
Heuer.
Too. Sure. Well, you know, we always have a lot of great stuff, but it's really the Avery I want to focus on. Last week we told the story how a gentleman came in, been threatening us since March to come in, and he did it. He came in with a duffel bag, dumped it out, 39 pounds of Yeerman and Tiffany and Avery, and most of it Avery.
Mostly Avery.
And so last week we sold an awful lot of Yeerman and Tiffany and John Hardy and other designer brands. And this week we've got to sell some Avery. It's probably 2,000 pieces of Avery. So tonight at 7 o'clock, the auction begins, and we're going to sell a lot of Avery. But something we don't ordinarily do, Wednesday evening in the gallery at 7 o'clock, we're going to have a James Avery auction. There'll be an online component, as we always have, but this time we'll be live also in the gallery Wednesday at 7 o'clock in Stone Oak at the Jewelry Exchange. 350 pieces of silver James Avery jewelry, all to be sold with no reserve whatsoever. If you bid a nickel and no one bid a dime, you just bought it for a nickel. However, I don't think that's going to happen, but theoretically it could. And there's so much Avery that Thursday night we're going to have part two of that auction. There'll be no live gallery, but we'll have it online only. And there's 352 lots. And so in any case, in the middle, tonight and Wednesday and Thursday, those three nights combined, there's probably 800 or more pieces of silver James Avery, all to be sold to the highest bidder. Just go, go, go. And that only leaves us with about an equal amount to take care of the next week. We're going to be selling estate James Avery jewelry. You know, for legal purposes, I should mention that James Avery is a legal trademark of the James Avery Company. We are not the James Avery Company, and this is estate jewelry that's been purchased by private individuals. And what we've done is we've cleaned it, we've steamed it, we've polished it.
Authenticated it.
It's real. I mean, sometimes we get a designer jewelry, and we have to give it back to the consignor. There are counterfeits even of Avery out there. All of this guaranteed to be authentic, all of it guaranteed to sell to the highest bidder with no reserves whatsoever. If you like James Avery, you got to come see us. And if you don't like James Avery, that's okay. Next Saturday, again, we'll have lots of other merchandise for you. Jewelry Exchange and Auction, 19903 Stone Oak Parkway in Stone Oak, San Antonio. Check us out online at www.jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And please come see us. You just won't believe what we've got. End of commercial. Every week we do the Insider's Report, where we try to tell you something about this business that we're in. We've had lots of jewelers, gemologists, antique dealers, people who are large dealers, small dealers. Tonight we're talking about dealing small. And not just necessarily starting out, but making the most of a small space and a small bankroll, and even making the most of a small knowledge base. A lot of people don't know an awful lot about this merchandise. And, you know, these reality shows that are on TV that are, I don't know why they call them reality shows. There's just nothing real about it. Behind every door is a fabulous, exciting fortune. And I was in that business in California. A friend of mine had three locations. That is so rare to open that door and find anything. Sometimes it just makes you sick. Literally sick what you find in there. But in any case, auction hunters and storage wars.
Not to mention that the owner of the unit rental place probably goes through it before anybody else sees it.
Well, I'm not accusing anybody local of doing anything, but I have seen owners go in, cut the lock, go in, go through the stuff, take what they want. They've got locks too, ladies and gentlemen, and they put a lock back on there, and on auction day it's like, okay, everybody, let's see what's inside. They already know that there's nothing to speak of in there. But in any case, here we're trying to share with you the tricks of the trade, and not all of it is pretty. But we see people come to our auction once, twice, three times, bid it up, and then we never see them again. And I know what's happening. Some people are showing up. They want to be in this business. They're buying merchandise with no particular knowledge of what they're buying, and they have no particular place to go with it, and they don't have a large bankroll, and they just can't keep coming and can't keep coming. And I want to, during this Insider's Report, I want you to understand what I consider the three most common mistakes that people make when they just start out and they're going to be dealing small. And I bet you that you think that the first thing I'm going to say is that they start out with not enough money, that they're starting out undercapitalized, that they don't have enough money in their pocket to be buying and selling and being in business. And that's not what I'm going to say. Because when I started, I had $2,000 of borrowed money in my pocket. And I don't know if that sounds like a lot of money to you, but most people, I think, that go into this business have a business of buying and selling almost anything, have $2,000 or more at their disposal. But they use it wrong. The three most common mistakes that I see people make, number one, they take on too much overhead. Overhead is the fixed cost that you have every week or every month. And I've seen it in so many different businesses, because I've been in a few where someone has a beautiful office and nice plants and nice furniture, and they hang up the artwork and they hire us a secretary or a front end or a back end crew, and then they say, all right, let's go get some customers. And I have never liked it like that. You know, if you have a big bankroll and you have a 5-year plan and you have a good, you know, team behind you, maybe that makes sense. But if you're saying, gee, I'm not so happy with my job and I think I might like to try buying and selling and starting a small business, well, you can't take your bankroll and do that with it. You have other uses for your bankroll. So I always encourage people, don't take on too much commitment for an overhead. There are people that we call vest pocket dealers who just do it out of their pockets, their jackets and their briefcases, and that's their entire overhead.
When we first opened, we spent about $25,000 on advertising, hoping to just kick it off with a bang, and there was almost no response from all that. But I think in the long run, looking back on it, it was probably a good thing, because we had very few employees. We had one part-time employee, and if 100 people showed up to the first auction, I think we would have looked like idiots.
Yeah, we couldn't handle it.
We wouldn't have been able to handle it.
It's good starting small.
So starting small and having some slow organic growth, I think, helped us work out the kinks without looking really stupid to new customers and saying, well, I'm never going back there again.
Right. Big advertising budget, big rent, big utility bill, furniture bill, personnel bill. No, start with the smallest overhead you can. We're going to mention how you might be able to do that. Also, the thing that I see people doing, they start with too little knowledge, and it's spread too thin. We've had customers come who've come to a couple of our auctions, and they see certain jewelry selling at certain prices, and they figure that that's what they can get for it, too, and they go out and they buy it, and then they want us to sell it for them, or they want to sell it themselves, and then they discover that maybe they can't get those prices because they just don't understand the jewelry. They don't have a venue. They want to break into the business and have very little money, and they spend their entire bankroll on one or two or three pieces, and had no real special knowledge of what they were buying and had no real plan what they were going to do with it. You know, I like what Chucky did. I keep mentioning this 13-year-old businessman that we have so much respect for. Chucky has special knowledge of exchange rates. If you have a bunch of coins and there's a bunch of Swiss coins and you have some Swiss francs there, and nobody I know wants a bunch of Swiss francs. I'm not going to Switzerland. You can't exchange them at the bank. Well, Chucky knows not only what the exchange rate is, but he has people to ship those to so that he can get probably 80, 85% of the exchange rate. He can, if you got a bunch of them, he can give you 75%, but he'd prefer to give you 50 or 30% of the exchange rate, and he'll pay you cash. And as a coin dealer, I'm happy to get rid of the stuff. I don't want it. I put it in a bag, and the bags go for $3, $4, $5, $6 a pound. But no, Chucky will pay me more for it, and he'll make more for it too. He also has a specialized knowledge of the silver content of different coins. When did Canada go from the 92.5% silver to the 80% silver? And what year do they have some 50% silver and copper nickel? And how can you pick out the copper nickel with a magnet?
Actually, so
you
don't just think nickel, right?
Well, just nickel, right. How can you pick that out with a magnet so even during that year you don't make a mistake? And Chucky knows this, and he knows the up-to-the-minute spot silver price. And he's not a little boy. He's not even a young man. Chucky's a robot, and he can just calculate these things in his head. And he picks away, and he just makes a few bucks here and makes a few bucks there.
He's got no overhead.
Chucky has no overhead, but some very specialized knowledge. His parents drive him all over the place.
He doesn't have to pay for gas.
They walk it. Yeah, they walk it as their overhead. Chucky's got zero overhead. And Chucky doesn't have deep pockets. Chucky doesn't have a lot of capital. He asks for an advance on his allowance. But he just takes that money and he moves with it. I've told my story before. I was 29 years old with no knowledge whatsoever other than that the price of silver was going up when someone came into 7-Eleven, where I was working at 7-Eleven, the night shift. For some reason, I thought that was funny. And he was buying candy bars with silver half dollars. I said, don't spend those. I'll give you a dollar each. The next day, I look in the newspaper because there's no internet then. And I find out that at the time, I get $15 each for those. So I put up a little sign, and people start bringing me silver coins. And it took about 2 weeks before I got fired because the owner could see what was going on there. I'm conducting business there, and I got a little sign there on the desk. So he fired me. But all I really knew was one thing. I only knew one thing. I knew that the United States stopped making silver coins, 90% silver coins, in 1964. If you gave me a quarter that was made in 64, it was 90% silver. If you gave me a dime that was made in 63, it was 9% silver. And by asking people what they would pay me, I knew what multiple, how many times the face value. A dime at the time was about $3, 30 times the face value. So if somebody says, what's a 1943 dime worth? Let me think, is that before 1964? And if it is, well, it's 90% silver. And so I was not a numismatist at the time. Gee, was that a particularly nice dime and worth a fortune? I don't know. It's 90% silver. I can get $3 for it. Now, what am I going to give you for it? And that's where the whole game began. And so that's all I did. People started saying, hey, silver rings? You buy gold rings? No. I was dragged kicking and screaming into the jewelry business because, no, I just wanted to buy the silver coins because that's all I knew. But one thing leads to another, and now we're one of San Antonio's authorities. I got my own radio show. I mean, we know a lot. What interests do you have that you could focus on? I'm telling you, you could make a living buying and selling silver-plated silverware, flatware, doing nothing but specializing in that. How about like new, really nice condition, DC Comics from 1970 to 1980? Is there a market for that? Somewhere there is. I know there is, and if you know something about that and you concentrate on that and you have a nice inventory and specialized knowledge, you could be the king of the like-new DC Comics printed in 1970 to 1980. Lincoln Memorial pennies from 1959 to now. You can specialize in those. There's not a great interest in those among coin dealers because they tend to be low value, but even the most low-value coins in higher and higher grades, they're scarcity. What's the most uncommon of all the common? And if you have those, people have to talk to you. A guy came into my gallery. I was probably 30 years old. I'll never forget this. He says, "Do you have any interesting fish bones?" And I'm thinking, I don't think anybody has any interesting fish bones. But, you know, after about 20 minutes, I understood what interesting fish bones were. And even in the back of my head now, I'm kind of always looking for interesting fish bones. You know, fishing lures, golf balls, what is your interest and what would you like to focus on? After the 7-Eleven, I moved my business to my apartment. I was fired. I had no income. I kind of had no choice but to focus on it a little more. And in retrospect, that was probably stupid. Whenever I answered the door, I had a shotgun behind my back, which was also stupid. I mean, that's not a self-defense weapon for an apartment. How could people find me? Well, it was before the internet, so I made up business cards, flyers, put them on bulletin boards, put a small ad in the newspaper, too. You look in the newspaper now or online now, everybody's buying gold and silver. How do you differentiate yourself? I did it with different laws. With different ads, I had an ad that says, "I break the law every day." It got people's attention. The law that says that big dealers pay more money than little guys do. And I'm a little guy. Okay, give me a try. I had topical ads around Christmas. I still recommend this to young dealers. Need Christmas cash? Because a lot of people do who might not think that they want to sell jewelry or not realize that coins might be valuable. But need Christmas cash? Also, I targeted people. So I buy class rings. People come and say, "Well, this is a 1923 Georgetown ring," thinking that maybe that's more rare than the Roxbury High School ring down the street. I didn't care. They're 10-karat gold. I'm going to put them all on a scale anyway. But it made them come in. Church bulletin boards or even the church bulletins, laundromats, homeowner association newsletters. We know a 7 or 8 year old boy who's running ads in his homeowner association newsletter. How about those guys dancing on the street corner with the signs? I mean, you figure it out. You keep your overhead down and maximize your safety. Meet people at restaurants. I used to meet people at my bank. I had a bank account. They had a conference room. I had a safe deposit box. Come on, let me use your conference room. They were happy to do that. In most cases, people will expect you to pay cash, but you can go negotiate the deal and say, "Okay, I'll be right back with the cash," or "Come to me with my bank," or "I'll meet you at Denny's in an hour with the cash." You can do that. Too much overhead, too little knowledge. And the third thing, not knowing what to do with something once you found it. I know dealers who got some great buys, and they're paying storage because they have storage rooms full of things and no customers, no real ability to sell it, no real desire to sell it, and they're always broke.
And meantime, the stuff is devaluing and you know,
getting smelly, getting yellow, getting rained on. That's how you survive with very limited capital, the immediate flip. Flip it, take your profit, go get some more, then flip that too.
I actually built a briefcase, a buying briefcase, where in a briefcase I have all my tools to buy and test just about anything, including the nitric acid and scales and files and clippers and magnets and just about everything.
Get clever.
And it's real easy. You can build one too. A loop, and I even do specific gravity machines. You can get reference materials. In fact, from our website, Jewelry Exchange and Auction, in the library section, there's all kinds of wonderful reference materials that where you can just start reading in there. The first thing you have to do is get an education, like David said.
Yeah, my favorite model, the ladies who go to garage sales, they only pick things that they think might be carat gold. They won't pay more than $5 a piece. They come in, they maybe have five pieces. They paid no more than $25 for it. Two, three, four of them are usually gold. They leave with $300. I've never seen them miss. Come up with a plan, but whatever you do, keep your overhead low. Keep your focus narrow. And keep your inventory moving flippity, flippity, flip. You can break all those rules later when you're big and rich and famous, but for now, low overhead, narrow focus, keep your inventory moving, flip it all the time. You can make some money and you'll avoid the headaches. And look, if everything goes sour, you didn't invest everything. You're not going to lose everything. So really, we're just trying to help you out here. We're about to take a hard break. KLUP is going to take you away for a couple of messages, but we're not going anywhere. We'll be right back with Pamela O'Neill from Pamela's Parlors. Don't go away. You're listening to In the Money with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. We'll be right back. We're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Our guest today, Pamela O'Neill from Pamela's Parlor. Welcome, Pamela. Thanks for joining us on In the Money.
My pleasure.
Tell me, what is Pamela's Parlor?
Pamela's Parlor is, it's a concept and it's also a physical location.
It's a state of mind.
Yes, part of state of mind. The overall business concept is it's antiques. It's selling and purchasing antiques and collectibles and all kinds of related things. Okay. The physical location is two different places, two different malls here in San Antonio.
Malls, antique malls.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to be asking you about that too, because frankly, I'm never quite sure how that works. So I can't wait to hear that from you. But you have two different places right here mm-hmm. in San Antonio.
Yes.
Where are they?
One is at 400 Pearl Parkway, which is just right in the heart of the exciting Pearl Brewery District.
And that's the one I see from the highway on 281
right.
every time I run
right.
downtown.
It's a growing just. Fantastic place. Lots of excitement. New apartments going in all over the place. Lots of shops, restaurants. It's just a fun, exciting place.
And the other location, I think, is toward the northern part
yes,
of town?
It's on Nacogdoches, north of Thousand Oaks. And it's a mall, and it's a very established mall that's been there 8 years, I believe.
That's Louis Bradshaw's mall?
Preston Bradshaw.
I guess his legal name is Louis, but he likes to be called, his middle name, I think, mm-hmm. is Preston. Okay. I always pick the wrong way to go with that, whether it's Preston or Louis. And in the antique mall, you share that space with other dealers.
Yes.
And how many other dealers would there be in an antique mall?
Well, depending on the format of an antique mall can be anywhere from just 10 dealers all the way to hundreds, depending on the specific mall. But it's the concept is multiple dealers sharing basically booth space,
and different square footages
mm-hmm.
depending.
And I assume that you've got to pay some kind of rent based
right.
on the size of your booth. But
right.
does the owner of the whole mall expect to get some kind of percentage of your sales, or how does that work?
There's generally speaking, the way it works is you pay a certain amount per square foot, or you may rent like a display case for a fixed amount. And then the owner of the mall generally takes a percentage of your sales.
I wasn't aware of that.
I think I think you've told me about some renting mall spaces, David, and you said they always ask for some percentage, and if you tell them to take a hike, they say, well, okay, here's the space anyway.
I can't talk about the people who own the Pamela's malls. I know that when I was just a kid in California, opening up my second location, it was actually a space in a shopping mall. It wasn't an antique mall. And I think, frankly, I think it was like 100 square feet. It was just this little booth. A key company had gone out of business. A company making keys for people got out of business. And I thought it would be a good buying station. And so we opened up, and in the lease was, it was pre-filled out. They wanted 8% of my gross. And I said, well, you know, we buy and sell bullion. Well, okay, well, and with the bullion, I mean, our profit margin is like 2%. I can't give you 8% of the gross on a $50,000 bullion deal. Well, what percent can you give me? The guy said. I said, 0%. And he said, okay, we changed it to 0%. So I don't mean to suggest that they would do that. I don't think they would do that at an antique mall. It's not part of their business model. But here, they were just taking a shot. But I was caught off guard. I think the incredulity in my voice, the emphaticness helped me get a 0% rate.
There is another model for the antique mall business, and that is where it's done more of a like a consortium, where there are multiple dealers that are together, and rather than paying for a booth space or giving a percentage of their sales to the owner, they are committed to being there all day long, 1 or 2 days a week.
Well, they work for their share, really. Yeah. It's just more of a cooperative. Yeah. It's kind of like a whole food cooperative that we used to have back in California when I was younger. They probably still exist, too. I just don't run like that anymore. So are you obligated to be at the mall at any time?
That is precisely why I started in the antique mall concept, because I did not want the responsibility of having to be there day in and day out. I wanted flexibility.
But I know that there are other dealers that you share space with overall in the mall, and I think some of them are obligated to be there. Is that just what they chose?
I talked to a couple
ladies who said that they work that.
You know, some are there just because they enjoy being there. Others are there. They're both employees and dealers. So at the location. On Nacogdoches,
that's just the way it works out. So I wasn't just sure how that worked. But tell me, full or part time for you?
Well, I'm retired, so that's kind of hard to say. It's full time without the hard hours.
Okay, it's always on your mind. You're always taking care of business, but you don't have to be there from 9 to 5. Mm-hmm. You know, what my father taught me when I was young, he says, when you're self-employed, you only have to work half days. 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, half days.
Fun or profit?
I think you told me once that you have a degree in Spanish and theater.
Yes.
And that comes in real handy in your antique business, right?
one of the reasons that I like the mall concept is that by nature I'm very reserved. I love antiques. I'm just passionate about antiques, but I'm not a salesperson. So what's nice is I have my things at both of these locations, surrounded by other people that also are passionate about the business. They're full-time employees there that take care of all of the things about paying sales tax and that kind of stuff. I've got someone else dealing with that, whether credit cards went through or not.
You're not eye to eye with the sellers. I know I hate that in the jewelry business. I mean, we don't do it, but there's a certain element of this goes with your skin tone, and this really matches your eyes, and I can't go there. It's like the car dealer who says, we're not trying to make money, we're just trying to make friends. You know, you kind of vomit a little in the back of your throat when you hear that. I just don't want to be part of that. But you've been dealing in antiques for a long, long time, right?
Well, I've been a collector since I was just itty-bitty tiny. I grew up in a household where my mother's idea of fun was to go to an antique store. So
I was reading on your website, you were saying that it was kind of a dream of yours for a while to have an antique store. And then I know a lot of people have dreams like that, and then they never end up doing it. But you actually did it. You just started up an antique store. How did you do that?
I actually kind of stumbled into it. I had always said for for 25 years that I was in the corporate world, it's like when I retire, I'm going to start an antique business.
You're in the insurance business, right?
Right, yeah. Right. And so it was always a nice, it was always nice to have this thing out there that you were shooting for. But because my mother had always been a collector, she and I were going to start this business when I retired. Unfortunately, she became ill in the last couple of years that I was my real job. So I wasn't able to make that dream happen with her. But when we got to the point where we were settling her estate, it just seemed a logical flow out of that. It's like, well, there are things that we need to do. We're going to have to sell some of her things. And it went from, instead of keeping it in storage, if you're going to pay storage, why not put it someplace where someone can see it?
Well, you heard my story about the silver coins and how I started, too. The opportunity was there. And I don't always get it. Sometimes you have to hit me twice before I see it. But there it was. I mean, you either go with it or you don't go with it. And, you know, we know that, you know, there's a lot of mistakes you can make and you're out of business in a week or two. But if you're still there after 6 months, I guess you're in business. Tell me something. Where do you get the merchandise that you sell?
From a variety of sources. As I said, I had a lot of things from my mother's estate. And then my husband lost both of his parents within a few months.
Sorry.
Of each other, and that was all in, you know, less than a 3-year period. We lost all of our parents, so it was part of it was just out of necessity. What do we do with these things? And being the sentimental person that I am, I didn't want to just, you know, just give it away. And it just doing the research about, well, what would something like this realistically be worth? If it's something that a family member is not going to take and appreciate for sentimental reasons, then what's a reasonable thing to do? So that's kind of how we got started.
And so then you put retail prices on merchandise, and the people in the mall know what your price is, and they either sell it or they don't sell it.
So did you try selling it out of your house at first, or did you go right to the antique mall?
I went right to the antique mall, and it's funny because that violated the rule that I had always had for myself about starting an antique business. I was not going to do bricks and mortar.
Right.
I was going to be smart. I was going to put it all
online.
Right. I was going to do stuff that way. But I physically had all of these big things that is kind of hard, unless you're very, very experienced, to have something on your website that's, you know, a massive piece of furniture and someone says, well, how do I get it? And
you go, there has to be a place.
Yeah.
Or you have to let them come to your home, and that's completely unacceptable.
Yeah.
I mean, we can
there's security issues for that.
Right.
So
I promised myself a virtual corporation when I started in California, and it was Adam's mother and me. And when we sold out in 2004, there were 60 of us.
Wow.
But, I mean, one thing leads to another. And I was saying in our gallery recently, I was saying we started 3 years ago with just Adam and me. And now there's actually 13 of us that produce this. And I was saying, do you want to be a sleepy little auction house, or do you want to have some fun? And there's only one answer to that. Let's have some fun. So you go with your opportunities. Mm-hmm. Tell me, who are your customers? Who comes to see you?
It's interesting. There are people who are bargain hunters that come.
Tire kickers, is that the same thing?
Yeah. And then but then there's also people who are looking for very, very, very specific things. And they can go from and they'd like the antique mall concept because they have a whole lot of dealers in one place. So when people like that come into a business, they let you know right away what it is they're looking for. So obviously you say you either have it or you have a way to get it for them. And or if you don't have it, maybe the person next to you has that or has access to that kind of a
I worked with a gentleman once in California, and people kept calling and asking us for a certain product. It was a different industry, and I'm a little embarrassed to tell you. It is legal, but I was a little embarrassed to tell you what it was. And they kept asking for this product, and he says, well, we don't make that. And they kept asking for it. I said, well, maybe we should make it. He says, well, it doesn't really work. I said, but they keep asking for it. It took about a year, and we finally made it. And, boy, sold a lot of it, made a lot of money. You got to know what your people want and make sure you have that, right? Mm-hmm. For us, it's always a math game. It's always a game of looking at the data. What have we been selling? Let's get some more. Mm-hmm. And the stuff that doesn't sell, let's stop. Come on. But it's amazing to me how many people don't do that.
Do you specialize in anything, Pamela, or is it just kind of just general merchandise?
My primary interest is in antique furniture. I love antique furniture. I had grown up with American antiques, but I have since expanded into more European things. But it's like you said, you start with what you know, and then you start learning about other things, and you move into it as you learn about them.
We've avoided furniture because, the schlep factor, you got to schlep it
here.
Thank
you.
you got to get a van, you got to get some smelly guys, and you got to start moving things around. Mm-hmm. So, you've been to our auctions. We've got young pretty little girls with black trays, and most things you buy, you can just put it in your pocket and take it home. Mm-hmm. Hey, you've heard us. We've been talking about dealing small, keeping overhead down when you're dealing small. Can I ask you, what's the cost like for a certain size space in an antique mall?
It depends on several things. Part of it is location.
You mean whether you're near the front door or the back door?
No, but physical location within the city.
Okay.
Or whether you're on the outskirts of the city or whatever.
So your space at the Pearl facility is a little more expensive than your space up in
yes.
the northern part of town.
Yes. So that's just has to do with the neighborhood that you're in. But it also depends on... I guess location probably is probably
it's
the primary driver.
Yeah.
I'm trying to
sure.
think of something.
Sure. Well, tell me though, and I don't want to get nosy. Although tell me it's none of my business. If you want, I can take it. If you had 100 square feet, I don't know how much space you have, but if you had 100 square feet, what might that cost in the two different locations that you where you have a facility?
It would be a scale. It would be somewhere between $2.50 a square foot to like $5 a square foot.
So $250 to $500 per month, mm-hmm. for a 100 square foot space.
A 10 by 10. Yeah.
Yeah, and depending on what you're dealing, you could move a lot of merchandise out of those. Mm-hmm. Is there good traffic in these places?
Yes.
Does the owner of the mall have some responsibility for driving the traffic, or is that all your problem?
It's a joint venture. The owners always do what they can to promote it, either through media or signs out in front or those kinds of things.
Well, if they're working for a percentage, then it's their mm-hmm. to their advantage to drive your traffic.
They keep the place clean and secure and everything.
Mm-hmm. And what other expenses do you have besides paying that rent every month? Do you have to share in the electrical bill or the heating and the
cooling?
What
your rent covers, your monthly lease
gotcha.
Is covers that.
Yeah, we've got a facility in Stone Oak in a strip mall, and mm-hmm. If the roof leaks, that's our problem. The air we've been there 3 years. The air conditioner gives out, and it just costs us several thousand dollars to fix it because, as mm-hmm. it turns out, that's our air conditioner. But if we leave, we're not allowed to take it with us. I don't like something crazy there.
No, the both places where I am, that's the owner's responsibility, and sometimes it makes me sad to see what they have to do to keep those places going.
I want to ask you briefly what special knowledge you have that allows you to be in this business.
That's a good question. Like I said, I've been a collector of things since I was a small child. So some of the things, it was just, you just kind of learned it, mm-hmm. along the way. The difference between, knowing there's a difference between mahogany and walnut or...
Right, I can't begin to do that.
Or right. rosewood
because
versus
we've
pine.
Because we've not exposed mm-hmm. ourselves to that.
So the, type of wood, different kinds of things like marble top versus just wooden top.
And you heard us say, too, that, Adam and I are flippers. That's what an auction is. The average lifespan of a piece of merchandise at our place is no more than 10 days. We just flip it and move on to the next thing. What's your philosophy about? I know people who say, I'm going to wait for the right buyer. I know what this is worth, and I'm going to wait for the right buyer.
To be successful long term, you have to be comfortable with being a flipper. And it takes a lot of people starting in the antique business a long time to reach that point, because many people get into the business the way I did was it's something they're dealing with someone's estate or whatever, and they're sentimental about the things.
Right.
So you have to be able to work through that process.
Yeah, my experience is that if I liked jewelry, then this would be my business would be a very difficult business to be in, because I'm handling a lot of it constantly. But to me, it's just stuff, and then I don't get emotionally attached. I see something that's nice, and I can appreciate it, but then I can sell it and move on.
Yeah, we try to reduce everything to a math problem.
Do you ever fall in love with any of the merchandise?
Oh, absolutely. And the other dealers that I work with laugh at me sometimes because I, when you adopt a pet from a shelter, you know how they grill you? Worse than, if you're adopting a child almost. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm kind of that way with customers. They're, it's like
You're trying to find the right home for your merchandise?
Absolutely. Not for everything, but for the sentimental stuff, it's like it has to go to the right person.
We have just about 1 minute left. I want to ask you if you have any advice to newcomers.
Start small. Overhead. Right. Remember that, because that will eat you alive before you even have a chance to get started.
And stay out of my neighborhood. Pamela, we always ask, what question do you wish we had asked you that we didn't ask you? Anything? Or are we just that good?
Oh, y'all are just great.
Oh, wonderful. Thanks for saying that. If someone wanted to contact you, they wanted to see what you had, if they wanted to offer you something maybe to sell, how can they contact you?
They can reach me through either the Antique Mall of San Antonio at Nacogdoches or through Pearl, the location in Pearl Brewery, because I'm in and out. The owners can find me.
They'll find me. And they can find all the phone numbers online.
Absolutely.
Excellent. You know, we're going to take a short commercial break now. Then we'll return to open up the phone lines here on In the Money with our special guest, Pamela O'Neill from Pamela's Parlor, and Adam and me, David Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction and co-host of KLUP's In the Money. Every Saturday evening, thousands of people just like you join our live auctions in Stone Oak. New and estate jewelry at up to 80% off retail, including brand names like Tiffany, Rolex, and James Avery. Rare coins and currency far below coin shop prices. And name your own price for all sorts of collectibles and small antiques with different merchandise every week. Bid live in the gallery or through our internet simulcast and never pay retail again. It's all happening at the Jewelry Exchange and Auction each Saturday in San Antonio. Texas license number 16604, member Better Business Bureau, call 210-592-8786 or visit jewelryexchangeandauction.com. That's jewelryexchangeandauction.com. And join us every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. for In the Money right here on KLU.
You're back with David and Adam Bluestein from the Jewelry Exchange and Auction on In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, what do I do with it? Our guest today, Pamela O'Neill from Pamela's Parlor. Adam, I think you have some questions, email questions, telephone callers.
Actually, we've got a caller on line one. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hey, Chris. We have Pamela from Pamela's Parlor on the line. And, she's our guest today. You're on the line.
You're on the line.
But do you have a question for us?
Well, actually, I've got two questions, okay? First off, I've been buying from junk silver and, a couple silver rounds from y'all at the Jewelry Exchange.
Yes.
And the first question I have is, what is the best thing to buy when you're dealing with a small budget? Coins, jewelry, bullion? I mean, when you just don't have thousands of dollars to go and buy, what is the best thing to buy?
Yeah, Chris, when we're dealing with customers who are just starting out, we always have to understand what is your purpose. If you want to buy something to flip, your best bet, I think, is to buy attractive jewelry as close to the metal value as you can, and then try to find someone who loves it, and they'll be willing to pay more than the metal value. If you're buying silver coins and you want to flip that, you'll be competing with us and lots of people like us who are willing to do it, Chris, for a 2% profit margin. And the only way we can do that is because we do hundreds of thousands of dollars a month. So if you want to do it to make money, I think you have to go with something where the value isn't easy to calculate because there's a factor of the beauty factor. And like we were saying before, does it go with their skin tone? Does it match their eyes? Some reason they might fall in love with it and want to pay more for it. And it's not so easy to just put it on a scale and say, well, gee, that's worth $35.42. What do you mean you want $40 for it? Did I explain that well?
That was actually a good description.
Good.
I mean, Thank you.
And you have another question.
The second question is dealing with specific coins, old coins, and, you know, just whatnot, you know, maybe old notes. I'm sure there's books out there that give some kind of a value of what these things are worth.
Yeah.
But I've noticed that the books basically give retail, and really nobody's buying retail.
Well,
I mean, nobody's paying top dollar. So what's out there besides what y'all do that can give me an idea of what something is actually valued at?
But you're absolutely right that the first thing you need to do is to find some reference material so you know what you're looking at. And I'll tell you that if you want to know the real world and not just what some guys in a room in Colorado Springs thinks that the coin value should be, then you should get online, go to eBay, and do some searches, and go to our show, What's Wrong with eBay? You can find it on a webcast on our website at inthemoneyradio.com, and we tell you how to do a search on eBay, the only search that counts on eBay. Any other search you do, if you do it any other way, you're not going to get good information. The problem is knowing that what you're searching for and what you're holding in the hand and what you see online are all the same thing, and that when it comes to coins, that comes down to grading. And almost no amateur grades correctly. And aside from getting started with, say, concentrating on one type of coin, Lincoln pennies, Morgan dollars, although that's an expensive way to start, Jefferson nickels, and start with something kind of inexpensive where you can afford to make a lot of mistakes grading, and it just won't cost you an awful lot of money. Start small, keep your overhead down, get some specialized knowledge, and whatever you do, flip it just as fast as you can. Hey, Chris, thanks for calling. We're out of time for this week. I want to thank Pamela O'Neill from Pamela's Parlor for joining us here today. We'll be back next Saturday at 7 a.m. with our new program, Paper or Plastic. We'll give you our insider's report, and we'll welcome our very special guest, David Astwood, local script... boy, I practiced this all day. I can't say the word. Scripophilist. That's a guy who deals in paper, ladies and gentlemen.
I thought that was somebody from Sesame Street.
Scruffalophagus? I don't know. If you have any questions about paper collectibles, call us at the Jewelry Exchange, 210-592-8786. Email your questions to questions@inthemoneyradio.com. We'll answer every single question. The best ones will be on the air. We hope to see you tonight at our live auction at the Jewelry Exchange, James Avery Week at the Stone Oak Jewelry Exchange, and we hope to see you again next Saturday for In the Money, the show that answers the questions, what is it, what's it worth, and what do I do with it? Thanks for joining us this morning. Have a great week.